another factor that will help me do this job well. I believe that the office of the Attorney General needs to be able to operate at an extremely high functioning level, to react to issues and crises, but also to be able to perform well at anticipating and solving problems and advocating for changes that are in the best interests of the Commonwealth as well as the people of the Commonwealth. Most importantly, and this has been on my mind for a while, and we've already started that, we need an upgrade in our technology internally. I have created and filled a new position of Chief Information Officer and given him the directive to inventory where we are and what we need to maximize our ability internally to keep inventory of cases, investigations, complaints, as well as to improve our own internal communication with each other and group by group. This means we need to install the hardware, the software, and the information technology staff that we need to be efficient, responsive, and nimble to our ongoing responsibilities and the new ones that will appear on our doorstep. We need to coordinate what we do across the state, not only in Boston, but with our offices in Worcester, New Bedford, and Springfield, as well as what we do cross bureau and division, either because the missions overlap or because they are at odds with each other, which is true. I learned early on that in the Attorney General's office, we often wear not one, not two, but sometimes three hats, and it's important to understand what those are and understand how we work with each other on those missions. Only by doing this, in cooperation with the Massachusetts Information Technology Division, can we then be a consumer and user-friendly office for those with a consumer complaint, for those looking for information, for instance, from our not-for-profit division, or trying to determine the status of a case that you have an interest in or you may be involved in. We need to quickly and easily provide information on internet safety or elder abuse reporting or what to do if your credit card information is stolen. Particularly, we can develop our web resources so they are easily navigable, they are substantively helpful, either with information we provide or with the links to the agencies or groups that do. We are developing benchmarks for our own short and long-term goals in this area. I believe that this upgrade is fundamental and crucial to our accomplishing all of our important missions. I would note that we are continuing our transition through the end of this fiscal year, including evaluation and review of staff and their functions. For instance, to see if our vacancies or attrition in the future, we can improve the functionality of the office with paraprofessionals and others, not just lawyers, and especially with the technology upgrade so that we can better perform our mission. We should be responsive, both in the way we are organized and our staffing, to what it is we are doing and should be doing. That also means that we are doing some reorganization on that org chart. That was the 3 a.m. nightmare during transition, waking up and worrying about org chart. It is a large office, as you know, almost 500 employees, and it has a great extent of wealth and experience. But one thing I wanted to do was take a look at how we are organized. Those of you in business understand the importance of that, to make sure that it reflects what we do and what we should be doing. We are in the process of realigning certain of the existing divisions so that our Public Protection and Advocacy Bureau, formerly called the Public Protection Bureau, will house those agencies like the Division of Consumer Protection, Environmental Protection, Civil Rights, and a newly created Healthcare Division. I'll talk more about that in a minute. I believe it also makes sense then to house the divisions that deal with business and business regulations in the same bureau so that the Division of Fair Labor Standards and other business and utilities regulatory divisions will be in the bureau now called Business and Labor Protection. We are separating the antitrust function from the Consumer Protection Division as they have different missions and ways to accomplish them. And we are also creating a new division of Business, Technology, and Economic Development. I want to give you a further note on those two new divisions. The Healthcare Division will work not only on the implementation of the new healthcare insurance bill and provide what I hope is a smooth working relationship with the Connector Board and all the other parties and agencies who have an interest in the success of that bill, but that group can also look at issues where the office intersects with consumers, healthcare providers, and insurance, the federal government, and other agencies. Particularly, this division can address medical privacy issues, nursing home and long-term care issues, and will work closely with consumer protection and insurance while spearheading advocacy at the state and federal level. For instance, as we look at long-term health care issues and costs, one of the initiatives of this health care division may be looking at decreasing costs in health care by precisely working on prevention issues, particularly with children, whether it's in looking at health care issues associated with lead paint or with increase in juvenile obesity. I will note that the issue of non-profit or not-for-profit healthcare organizations will still primarily be handled in the charities division, but because those issues overlap, we can work, I think, successfully with the healthcare division and look at the issues that overlap with the nonprofits. The second division, the Business, Technology, and Economic Development Division, is frankly a little bit of a new concept. And as we work out exactly what its mission is and how we succeed in doing that, I invite those in the business community to help us with this, because it seems to me that I can provide through this division an opportunity for the vetting of issues that are important to the business community, which may or may not intersect with other important functions in the office, including consumer protection and our enforcement of the Fair Labor Standards Act. One immediate project that we wish to undertake is to review our current set of statutes and regulations that affect the business community to see which are necessary, useful, or out of date, and which may be expensive or cumbersome without providing any measurable benefit to consumers or to other community members. I will tell you that I believe in walking and talking softly, but also carrying the big stick that litigation and enforcement provides, but I also believe that you hold that stick until you need to. I think that we need to take the short and long view to promote a healthy economy, not at the expense of progress we have made in consumer protection or enforcing rights of organized labor, but in fact to recognize that all problem solving need not be adversarial, that's the walking and talking softly part, and that often little progress is made just by the high-profile enforcement. Even Elliot Spitzer seems to be taking a kinder, gentler approach to some Sarbanes-Oxley regulations now that his hat is that of governor and not attorney general. Make no mistake about it, for the egregious or recidivist violator of the law, whether contractor, wholesaler, or business, we will be vigilant in our use of the big stick, because I also know that for businesses who follow the law and who provide for the best opportunities in the state, they also want the laws enforced. And I think that's true of financial institutions and businesses. But I believe that we do a better job for consumers, for labor, for the public, when we understand and vet the consequences of all of our actions. And we provide solutions that sometimes no one advances because the relationships have become so adversarial. I fully expect to have to explain the decisions that we make, that I make or that our office makes as the Attorney General's office, and I believe the Attorney General's office works best and is most successful when we are transparent. I fully understand that I may be at my most successful when no one person or group is totally happy with a particular result. But my goal is to be effective and not necessarily popular. And that means that I will hear what the interests are of people who will be affected by what we are doing. Let me give you a specific example of what I think we can accomplish with this new approach, particularly with a new division that looks at where the business where business needs to go and where it needs to be in Massachusetts. Since its creation in 1998, the Attorney General's Brownfields Covenant Program has successfully solved liability problems and led to redevelopment of contaminated sites across the Commonwealth. Now is a very good time to review this program and see how we can improve it. We will evaluate what we do with public input to try to increase development and cleanup. We understand, for instance, that liability is a huge concern for developers, and that the wide net of Chapter 21E liability can impede projects and discourage buyers, developers, and lenders. Other examples of where we can be helpful: stem cell research and other biotechnical initiatives should be encouraged and not discouraged by regulations promulgated that contradict the spirit of recent progressive legislation. As part of our review of existing regulation, we plan to take a look at regulations developed by the last administration that raise serious concerns about whether they are in the interest of the Commonwealth and in the spirit of that legislation. And in addressing the growing demands and expensive energy costs, I think it requires a thoughtful short- and long-term plan with all of those who have a vested interest in energy, especially, but not only consumers, in looking at how we go forward to meet the demands of Massachusetts in the next few years. And as we address issues around identity theft and the security of confidential financial data, we can take a lead from other states who have addressed these issues and understand there's an enormous amount at stake here. First, the safety and security not only of our private industries and computer infrastructures, but of our government. What happens if the infrastructures of not just financial data, but of the government are hacked into? We need to also improve consumer confidence in the ability of companies to keep information safe and to provide notice when there is a breach. We need to address consumers' need to address identity theft and loss of credit ratings quickly and effectively, and there needs to be a better way for people to restore their identities and their credit. We need to review law enforcement's ability to use administrative subpoena, as we do now for telephone records, to be able to act more quickly and to mitigate damage when financial information is stolen, when healthcare information has been compromised, or a child is missing and we know he's been in contact with someone on the internet. And I might indicate that this is a tricky area to navigate as we look at privacy concerns and the concern of big government having too much information. We can't give the upper hand to those who are smarter and quicker at hacking into our systems with an illusory effort to try and protect individual privacy when, in fact, we're not addressing it at all. Let me make a quick note about education. I believe that Massachusetts is one of the greatest tools to reinvent ourselves and to keep pace with the demands of the 21st century, and that is our strong educational system. Yet we could do more with our kindergarten through 12, and particularly, I believe, with our vocational technical schools for updating technical and language skills for students not headed to four-year liberal arts colleges, or for those reentering the workforce after parental leave or other leave, for prisoner or reentry or probationers who would work if they had the skills that this state needs. If we are thoughtful and comprehensive about this, it's a win-win for employers and the criminal justice system. Our schools and our ability to educate people is perhaps where the real and only prevention begins. In K through 12 for our urban and, as we saw recently, our suburban schools, we need a focused and multidisciplinary approach to that. And the fact that it is never perfect and tragedies will occur does not mean that we should not be committed to it. My note this morning about the big dig, we are continuing to work vigorously on resolution of the criminal and civil issues. I believe we will be able to do that. And beyond that at this time, I have no further comment. In short, I have to tell you that it's been tremendous for me to serve both as district attorney and now as attorney general. I love this Commonwealth, but as I've noted before, we continue to have one foot in the 21st century and one in the 19th. Let's all maximize our ability to keep us safe individually, as communities, as a Commonwealth, to promote civil rights, an important initiative for the Attorney General, to educate and protect our consumers, to protect our precious environment, and to promote a healthy economy by advocating vigorously for our own particular interests, but understanding again, individually in our communities and our business lives, we are also a Commonwealth. I will commit my skill and resources to build on an office which has a tremendous history of talent and expertise, to hope to, through this transition, streamline it, make it more responsive. With your help and the help of our elected officials and residents of Massachusetts, we will try to do what's best for Massachusetts, to do the best that is humanly possible. We cannot do more than that. Thank you, and I'd be happy to get comments and questions.
Very good.
Thank you.
Very, very good.
Thank you.
I'll start the questions, and again, we're going to try to do... Martha, thank you very, very much. As I mentioned, there are microphones out in the audience. If you have a question, would like you to speak into the microphone. Arthur, let me begin. First, congratulations on a reorganization that seems to deal with 21st century realities, both in healthcare and business. You talked a bit about a focus not only on review of statutes, but also of regulations as they impact economic growth and development. Could you expand on that just a bit? And do you envision a pilot? Do you envision, how do you envision working to look at what has become a maze of regulations that oftentimes don't realize their initial objectives?
Well, first of all, as you might realize, it is a large project, and I want to do it in an organized way. First is staffing up that division, which we are in the process of doing. But secondly is beginning to work, I think, in a concrete way, both in substantive areas, and that's where, Paul, the Chamber and other organizations that know what the problems are can be very helpful to us in looking at what is outdated, what is in the way, what we need to. And this is where I think we plan to establish a way to get that input from the business community. And I think probably, although I haven't determined, that it makes sense to do it by subject area. That is, as we look at healthcare, as we look at retail, as we look at banking, to the extent that we have authority over banking that has not been preempted by the federal government, I think it's best to look that way. But we will encourage and provide ways in which we can do that informally and also in a more public forum to start to take a look at it. I know that under Governor Weld, and I know Charlie Baker's familiar with an effort to do that, to take a comprehensive look at what the state was doing, I believe, to be where the government should be, helpful, enforcing when important, but not regulating for the sake of regulating. And so we will be in touch as we develop the mechanism for us to do this. But in the short run, if you have ideas or suggestions or interested in working with us on it, I suggest you can contact me. You can contact my first assistant, David Friedman, because we are interested in trying to get this off the ground, figure out the scope and how long it will take.
Questions for the general. Paul.
When you have the degree of concentrated violence, particularly youth violence, that Boston's experienced over the past 2 years, is there a role for your office in terms of providing resources, leadership, direction, assistance in any way to a city like Boston?
I believe there is, and I am confident, because we have been there before, Paul, that we can try and look at what has worked and what has changed since the early 90s, for instance, when in Boston or in Lowell, where I'm familiar with the efforts, what are the new factors that make it difficult to get this problem where we, you know, we're never going to eliminate urban violence, but it is at an unacceptable level for the city and for the people in this city. And part of, we have a very active program now, our Safe Neighborhood Initiative, where we fund and provide for individuals who work, particularly in Boston, but not just in Boston, because you see it in Boston. It's also in our other large communities. But as Ralph knows as well as I do, we approached this problem in the early 90s with a concerted federal, state, and community effort. We also had a lot of resources then, money, dollars, that we do not have now. And we were the victim of our own success. As this program worked and people got comfortable, we dropped those relationships and we lost the grant money. And now we're in some ways starting from scratch. We also have additional problems because as we saw a boom in the population and young men between 18 and 25 who are either getting out of school or unfortunately getting out of prison, we have a bump right now that is causing, because of the population, because of a spike in violence. I think we shouldn't be despairing, but we should not. Pay attention to this. A couple things. I am hopeful that with the new commissioner, who I know is committed to and is very successful at community policing, he can take the lead. We have to involve the schools, and so there needs to be a commitment by the new superintendent and the principals in Boston to work with law enforcement. We need the community involved. We need to look at the jobs piece of it. And frankly, we also need to focus on those small number of kids who have become dangerous and need to come off the street. It's easier said than done. It can be done, but it takes the resources and the will. we can be involved, I believe, in terms of resources, people, and in planning. And I'm hopeful that we can do that. I think my experience as a district attorney in dealing with Lowland and seeing what's happened can be helpful. And you have my commitment because I think it's a really important issue. I would add that in our criminal division, we have a new bureau chief. I have made two deputies because we have one, John Grossman, who will be the deputy to deal with our white-collar internet public corruption issues. That was the division he headed. He's very good at it. But we have a very experienced deputy, Marcy Jackson, whose experience has been in this area. And I want her to focus with our staff, with communities, to see what we can do to help and try and move forward on some of the things that we've known have worked in the past.
Other questions? Jerry.
Good morning, General. I think it's great that we have a general and a chief in the Commonwealth now who is a woman. I wanted to ask, though, about identity theft. It seems as though, reading the paper, that no one really has a handle, state or federal, on identity theft. And you alluded to the fact that other states might be ahead of us. Could you speak more specifically on what can be done on the question, particularly with respect to consumers?
Sure. And I think it needs to be approached on a bunch of different levels. But we are interested in, because, for instance, there are several pending bills before our state legislature. I think this is an excellent time, and I think there is the will on the Hill to do that. We're looking for a new poet laureate, too. So there is a will on the Hill to look at this issue. And really what I think is important to focus on, what are the problems? What are we talking about here? What immediately comes to mind is, what is the liability going to be? What's the responsibility on those businesses or agencies that collect that data? And how do we protect that infrastructure so that we prevent as many breaches as possible? It's fair to say, I think, is we are not going back to trading beads or sand or even dollar bills. We're going to be in a paperless society. We are going to continue to use transactions that can be breached. We need to improve the ability to protect them. But we need to provide for, and I think this is going to look at it will require looking at the federal government also, because they are the ones who regulate the banks and the credit card companies largely. What are the penalties for breach? Who bears the cost of that? And most importantly, if it occurs, because we know it will, how do we let consumers find out about it, rectify their own situations, mitigate the damages? And there's a lot to be done. And there are bills that are somewhat omnibus, and some of them focus on the problem exactly. But I know there's a seminar in March sponsored by the federal government. The Secret Service handles most of the credit card issues. But I think this is an excellent time. You know, TJX is not the first time it's happened, but you know it's going to happen again. And all of those things need to be focused on. I think we can be helpful in looking at what other states have done, what's the best way to move with legislation, and make sure that we provide the education for consumers. But I think it's a huge issue in terms of consumer confidence, for instance. If businesses are going to continue to attract customers and hopefully use their credit cards, we need to provide ways in which people are confident that they will do it. So lots of pieces to it, but that's, I think, we need to put it together. And by the way, that's also an issue where we hope to get from those who are affected by these new, if we pass new statutes or develop regulations, let's figure out what's going to work. Everybody in this room has a lot of expertise around this that can be helpful, I think, in trying to resolve this.
Martha, you've had an interesting sort of transition reviewing the office. I wanted to ask you about somewhat of a mundane topic, but one that I think is really important, which is the compensation structure of the office, because, of course, everyone here in the business community and the legal community understands that recruiting and retaining really talented lawyers and other professionals is the linchpin of the office. And I'm sure that everyone here who's been interacting with government agencies or the Attorney General's office for years understands that the pay scale of that office is particularly disparate from what folks in the private sector make. And I wonder if you have considered that and considered that whether or not there might be an opportunity now to remedy some of that disparity, to really ensure that the future of the office is protected.
Thanks, Cheryl. Good question, and I've been acutely aware, both as district attorney and now as attorney general. In an ironic way, it's worse in the attorney general's office, although the salary levels are higher. the kind of work that's expected, the hours and the experience level that's needed to deal with large companies who have expensive lawyers is even greater. In the DA's office, the starting salary is now $37,500. But if you have the ability to do that, it's great experience. You can start out of law school and get some experience and move on or stay. In fact, what we have seen in transition is that trying to attract some talent at the bureau level, division level, it's impossible. If you are a lawyer in Boston at the level of experience that I would like, very few people can or will take a pay cut in order. If you have a mortgage, you have a family, you cannot do it. And so the gap between what we expect our public lawyers to live on, particularly in a state that's expensive, has become I think, a detriment. And so that is a huge issue. I mentioned it. We had a large staff meeting out at UMass the other day where I spoke with staff about my priorities. I said one of the best moments for me before I left the DA's office, cases aside and all the important work that we did, was being able to give an across-the-board 10% raise to people. Now, for some people, that was $3,000 or $4,000. That was a 10% raise because those salaries are so low. But we need to do that, and we need the bar's help and the business community's help, because we are going to continue to not attract the talent that we should. And I appreciate the question. I know my staff appreciates the question. And I have told them that I am committed to upgrading the professional level of what we can do. No one is there to get rich, trust me, and the hours people work, but people need to be able to live and to survive. And so I am committed to that. I think it's important as the upgrade in technology, it's as important to send the message that what we do is important, and we're going to recognize it by the salaries we can pay people.
Ralph.
General, as the state considers legalized gambling in a number of forms, can you talk about some of the concerns, substantively and otherwise, that you'd want the state legislature and the governor to consider?
Sure. I haven't taken a position on it. It is a complicated issue. The caveats I would make, as someone who's worked particularly as a federal prosecutor and as a state prosecutor, two things. One, make sure, although it's very seductive to look at what the potential income would be to this Commonwealth, everybody needs to understand what the real benefit in the Commonwealth's till will be on a dollar value when you cost it out. And the other piece of it is all of the hidden costs that are involved with this, because I firmly believe that once we, if we go that route, there are other costs that people don't want to talk about in terms of law enforcement, in terms of what we have to do to keep this safe. It's a cash business. It's going to be subject to money laundering. It's going to be subject to infiltration by, and I use the term organized crime extremely loosely, but some sort of money laundering, organized crime costs. People, I understand the attractiveness of it, but be careful, I think, before we do it. I think it needs to be thoroughly vetted before or if we go down that road. And I know we'll be involved in that. I will be open-minded about it. I haven't reached a decision, but I think we need to be very cautious. Atlantic City is not a booming place these days, and I think we need to be careful.
One of the questions that was asked deals with the subject of immigration. How will you approach dealing with businesses that employ illegal immigrants, and what is your general view on this entire area as it applies to the state and the nation?
First of all, we have a huge crisis, much of which needs to be dealt with on the federal level in terms of figuring out what we are going to do. We don't have the ability to do much of it at the state level. Having said that, we deal with everyday issues that either for which immigration is the tail wagging the dog or is part of the central issue. And my approach is that as I am not concerned with the immigration status per se of individuals, because I cannot be as a state official, I am concerned about either businesses that exploit those individuals and break the law. In other words, if they are not withholding, they're not paying health insurance, they're paying under the table, the employers are breaking the law. That's an important issue that we have committed to enforce to make sure that companies are dealing on a level playing field. If you are obeying the law, your costs are going to be higher. And I have heard that because the extent of the problem in Massachusetts has reached the levels it has, there are legitimate businesses that will not bid on a project, construction or otherwise, because they know they're not going to get it. That has to end, and we need to deal with that issue at that level. Having said that, I do not believe that it's useful or effective to assign a certain number of state police to pick up immigrants, because where are they going to go? I know from being a state law enforcement and federal enforcement officer that there are ways in which we can contact, or the federal government knows about, those immigrants who are dangerous. But it's not because they're immigrants, it's because they've committed a crime. The federal government has to resolve what they are going to do about that and what they are going to do going forward for a workforce. I know General Riley's policy was to enforce the law, but not to focus on the immigration status so much as the individual. And clearly we all know that if someone has been a victim of a crime, whether it's domestic violence or exploitation by labor, we are concerned with protecting their rights as individuals. But I know it's a huge issue. We're going to look at this and hopefully to be concise going forward with a humane approach. But we need to put pressure on our congressional delegations and our executive on the federal level to reach a resolution that will help us resolve at a state level what we want to do about this.
Yes, right over here, Carol.
General, to follow up on that question, you mentioned in your formal comments civil rights and the Civil Rights Division. Could you tell us what your thoughts and plans are in that particular area?
It is a division in our new Public Protection and Advocacy Bureau where we are about to decide on a new division chief. We have not had a division chief for some period of time, and we have done some initiatives. When I say we, the office has done some initiatives on, for instance, after 9/11, on backlash for those of Middle Eastern descent. We have looked at individual problems that come out of race or gender. But I am hoping that with a new division chief and a focus on not so much, because I don't believe we have a huge issue that we need to react to, but we do. We constantly deal with housing issues. We deal case by case of cases that come to us. I'd like to be more accessible to people who believe they have civil rights problems so that we can deal with them either individually or case by case. But to step back now and take a look at where should our initiatives be in the schools and in our communities around the issues where individuals or groups feel that they are discriminated against. And as I said with my theory of, everything's not solved by litigation, what is it that we can do around education and mediation on civil rights issues? I do not pretend that we do not have civil rights problems in this state. We do, and some of them are hidden and some of them we don't come to our attention. So it's both having the staff in place to respond to issues that we know are there, but also making sure that the public feels that they can come to us with complaints, with issues, that we will have the staff to investigate. That, by the way, is part of what I need to be able to do with the infrastructure to make sure that people can contact us by phone, mail, email, whatever it is, and that complaint will be reviewed, processed, that there will be a response to people. That's just as an efficiency matter, but civil rights is one area where that's particularly important, I think.
Time for one or two last questions. Right in the back, please.
Martha, all of us make mistakes in the work that we do, and what I've learned in business, as I'm sure many here can attest, is that people don't judge you by whether or not you make a mistake. They judge you by how you deal with it once it's made. My question is, when a prosecutor makes a mistake, an innocent person can go to jail and a criminal can roam free no longer being looked for. I'm sure you've thought a great deal about this, and I'm wondering if you would be kind enough to share your thoughts with us this morning.
I have, and I'll tell you that certainly having the opportunity a couple years ago to file a null pros in a case where we had convicted a man in Lowell, Dennis Mahar, of rape, not of one, but of three counts, three different victims, in reviewing that case and determining that there was no conscious or intentional misconduct, that the witnesses had all looked in a non-suggestive way at photo arrays and picture books and lineups, that the police had behaved appropriately, but we just made a mistake, and we knew it when we did the DNA testing to realize that not only Was it not Dennis Maher? It was two different people, both of whom, as you note, are still at large. It is a very sobering experience for a prosecutor to understand that. It's one of the reasons why I am against the death penalty, because that is, if you you cannot change your mistake you've made on that, certainly. But in a more positive sense, the fact that we have much more extensive use of DNA, which means we can include and exclude people. And I think, frankly, and I've seen it for the last 20 years, that our training with police around identification procedures, we've taken advantage of what the social studies have told us about what is likely to cause a mistake given the process that we use. We've done extensive training in the state. I worked with the other DAs and with General Riley around a justice initiative on many of these issues. We will not completely eliminate mistakes. I know that. But it's our obligation as prosecutors to put in place the ways to eliminate mistakes. We do have places, some of us think sometimes ad infinitum, where people can file motions for new trials. But I do believe in balancing the rights of victims to move on with their lives, that it is important to get it right. We understand that, you know, it doesn't matter how many rightful convictions we get. The wrongful conviction is one that we have an obligation to eliminate and to make the change when we understand we've made a mistake. I've had the opportunity to do that. I firmly believe in that as having been a defense lawyer and understanding through my career that my job is not to get convictions. My job is to do justice. And I think we cannot rest on that. I think we need to continue to make sure that the processes we use, the work we do at the lab, lets us do this in a way that the public has confidence and that we are confident that the result we get is right. That's our job. That will be part of my job as Attorney General, and I am committed to that.
Last question. You mentioned the new division of healthcare. One, how do you view your office being involved, if at all, in the implementation of the new health care law? And second, do you think there is any way that your office can play a role in controlling the escalation of health care costs?
The second question is a tougher one. I don't know the answer to that. I think that, and I have said this, there is an escalation of costs in some respects that we can help with, whether it's looking at administrative issues, looking at preventive issues. I know it's a long-term solution, but we as a Commonwealth can cut back on smoking, look at childhood obesity, look at some of the things that contribute to a high cost of health care. And I think we all have to be part of that, and that means looking at what is required? What is the new technology that maybe saves diagnostic procedures, that saves costs because we develop it and approach it that way? But the other piece of this, Paul, we talked about this the other day, is that healthcare is expensive. And I'm a firm believer that some of this debate we have about the cost is done in the abstract because people don't really understand what the costs are. And some of this, we just have to understand that it is expensive to pay for healthcare, not healthcare insurance, to pay for healthcare. If we want the best, if we want to be, as we are, a leader in healthcare, there has to be some public education about what it costs. And so when we decide on what that premium is or what it's going to cover, there should be a realistic approach by people to understand that this is not just a check I'm paying for something that other used to be free. This is payment for something that I need, that's essential, that we agree as a society is important, and I think we have. But the cost issue is tricky. In terms of the bill itself, the Connector Board is working on it. We will, I hope, with this healthcare division, be able to look at some of the other issues around either challenges to it or the need to develop regulations. I'm not sure what role exactly we want to play, but as lawyers, we represent the agencies and will defend the statute. But as problem solvers in this healthcare division, I hope we can work with others trying to make sure, if we can, get this bill to work. The whole country is looking at what we do. The devil is in the details in terms of can we make it affordable. But I sense that people want to make this work, and to the extent we can help with that, we will. But there has to be, I think, stepping back, a real understanding of what it is we're trying to do. And it's healthcare insurance is different from car insurance. And what it pays for and what it is expected to pay for is different. That's a whole consumer education piece that we need to get people involved in so that there will be buy-in for this bill, I think.
Thank you very, very much, Martha.